Hi, in today's episode, we have Masum Parmar. Masum hails from the Heredity Langa community of musicians. He's a curator and arts manager based in Bangalore. Influenced by his own diverse ancestry, his work explores ideas of identity and belonging through the oral, literary, and cultural heritage of the subcontinent. Masum is invested in finding the secular and contemporary in the classical forms of Bharatanatyam and Kathak. His commitment to making the arts a commercially viable career finds expression in associations and collaborations with established and emerging artists across India. Masum Parmar is a certified drama queen and a penchant for breaking rules and hearts, and he's already broken mine. I'm just really stopping myself from not staring at him for too long. Welcome, Masum, on today's episode.
Thank you so much for that generous introduction.
How is it that you've got those dimples on your cheeks? And have you got that from your mom, your dad, or you were just born with those dimples?
Well, anatomically speaking, it means I'm missing a muscle. So it's more of a deficit. But neither my mom nor my dad have it. So,
and they're like deep dimples on both sides of the cheek.
I keep asking them, are you sure I'm your child? Because there are certain things that are not matching here.
So tell me a little about your journey. How did you land up in Bangalore, you know, and just, you know, when you say that making it commercially viable for artists, it's something that all artists struggle because we're all the time struggling with validity. And how is it that your experience has been towards this that you're working?
Okay. Talking about moving to Bangalore, I think it was a very natural step. I was studying physiotherapy in this small town called Murbidri, which is near Mangalore. And I was just about to finish my internship. And ever since I knew or what I want to be, I knew it was, I wanted to be in the arts. I wanted to be a dancer rather. But as I sort of grew up and interacted with dance, because I was also very active in my college, I was more in the performing arts department than in the physiotherapy department. I realized that there is this huge gap because there are so many dancers in this country, but there are very few platforms where we can perform. Especially with classical dance, there are millions of classical dancers. And the platforms that we had, a lot of them were where we had to pay and perform. I come from a very, very humble background. My parents would have never been able to afford it. And I knew that that's something what I didn't want to do as well. So that is when I sort of said, maybe I should see how I can do something else, but within the arts circuit. And there was an opening for a company in Bangalore for an administrator's position. And I applied for that. I got the job and I moved here. Coming to your second question about making it commercially viable. Again, this comes from lived experiences where we, even while we were in college, we used to perform almost every weekend. And it, of course, it's just a 45-minute performance, but the practice that goes behind it, there is hours of rehearsals, hours of sweat.
Absolutely.
The damage that you do to your body because you're pushing it, you know, you're exerting your body beyond its limits. We were compensated with like 100 rupee. Sometimes even that wouldn't be there. We would just be given dinner after us and it's like, okay, we are done. And I found that really challenging because I was living by myself. I was estranged from my parents during that time. I hadn't spoken to my mother for a really long time. And there was this thing like, I will never ask them for money, you know. Mm-hmm. So how do I survive in this space that I'm in now? And that's where this idea of making dance commercially viable started. And what I started doing was, when I started curating events, I made sure I charge a ticket price. Because dance, up until at least 2012, was a free show. You come, you watch, you appreciate, you leave.
I think that's mostly for most arts in India. It's really sad.
And I realized, why are we not paying for it? You are appreciating it. Why are we not paying for it? So we started ticketing shows. We started calling sponsorships. And even when we had commercial events, we started asking for rightfully what was ours. We used to be offered a pittance. And then I took this step where I said, no, the artists that I work with, they won't dance for this money. We put in all the costs of our rehearsals, our studio space. And that's how this whole idea of you know, making dance commercially viable started. And then it has also sort of spilled into my activities with the Manganyar artists, the Langa artists that I work with now.
Tell me a little about the Langa artist. You know, people living in the north probably know a lot.
Yeah.
And there's a huge exposure. And I'm always fascinated with the Manganyar and the Langa musicians.
So the Langas are, they're a subset of a larger community in the north, primarily originating in the regions of Sindh and Rajasthan. My ancestors, I believe, moved from Rajasthan to this small town called Dhrangadhra in central Gujarat, in Saurashtra. There are two kinds of langas. There are the Saraini langas and then there are the Sarangi langas. The Sarangi langas are the ones who play the Sarangi.
Oh my God, the sound of the desert.
Yeah, and the Saraini langas are the ones who play the winged instruments. And I belong to the Saraini langa community myself. And everybody in my family, my uncles, my cousins, my dad, they're all musicians. They sing or they play an instrument. We primarily deal with a lot of folk music, but it is very secular in the sense that I know my dad doesn't eat non-vegetarian food when he's singing during the Navratri time. I know a person from the Langa community who used to sing bhajans at the Ambaji temple in Rajasthan for years, and he was pure vegetarian. Yet, he also used to do his namaz. So I think it's a very unique community in that sense, and that's actually true for all the folk communities that are there, because they coexist with the religion that they practice and then the form that they practice. So yeah, and that sort of also resonates then into my dance practice, where I perform Bharatanatyam, but what is the secular in that, you know? Those are the investigations that have been fueled through this lived experience.
So tell me a little about how, when you say secular in Bharatanatyam, explain to me, you know, what you mean by that.
So traditionally, as we all know, Bharatanatyam originates from the temple traditions in the Telugu and the Tamil speaking countries. And of course, during the nationalist movement in 1947 to 1955, it was revived and reorganized and restructured. But the text that it primarily deals with now is from the Hindu traditions, if I have to say so. I mean, there are Shaivite texts, there are Vaishnavite texts. And my primary questioning around this was, I am practicing Bharatanatyam, but I'm also Muslim. So how does my faith find its place in this form, which is very highly religious, Hindu religious, right? And that's where the investigation sort of began. It was also fueled by my contemporary training, where you look at contemporary movements as just movements. They don't have a meaning ascribed to it, right? They don't draw from certain literature. They don't draw from certain tradition. They are very universal in nature. So that's where my investigation started, with that point, saying, if I use Bharatanatyam movement, is it still Bharatanatyam? What makes it Bharatanatyam? Does the text make it Bharatanatyam? Does the movement make it Bharatanatyam? Or is it a combination of both of the things? And I started using, way back in 2007, I started using Sufi texts. I've dealt with love poems from Shah Latif. I've dealt with poems from Bulle Shah. I dealt with Kabir. And while I was still doing this, I still felt like I'm not doing enough. It is still somewhere, I'm still ascribing something to it. So I went back to the roots and I created this piece, which is what I called Allah Ripu.
Allah Ripu.
Allah and Ripu. Actually, traditionally in Bharatanatyam, we have a piece called Allah Ripu, which is the first dance sequence they teach us when we learn all the basic steps. And the Allah Ripu is designed with the idea of entering a temple space. I said, what if I'm entering a mosque?
Wow.
Because the movement of the original Allah Ripu are influenced by a temple's architecture. They are very diagonal, very lines, geometric. And I studied mosque architecture. I spoke to people who were building mosques, who had experience in that. I studied different kinds of mosque architecture.
Tell me a little about the mosque architecture, because it's so unique, you know?
Yeah. See, when we see in a temple architecture, they say it is designed from in the shape of a man who's lying down. The entrance is the feet, and where the god is placed is your Anjaneya chakra, your topmost chakra.
Yeah.
The mosque architecture is, it's actually, there are multiple architectures, styles. The one that is commonly found in India is the one with a very big courtyard. And then there's just, there are minarets. And the minarets are supposedly the four pillars of Islam, which is namaz and zikr, giving money to people, doing hajj. And there's one more which I can't recall right now. But there are four pillars. So they represent the four pillars of Islam. The center is always positioned in the direction of the holy Kaaba. And it's called a mihrab.
It's called the mihrab.
Mihrab. M-I-H. Mihrab, yeah. And near the mihrab, there are three steps which signify the steps that lead to heaven. Which is where the priest or the Maulvi, he would be on the first or the second step, depending on how educated he is in religious scriptures, and he renders out the namaz. The namaz is actually not supposed to be on loudspeakers. Now it happens. But there are also a lot of curves you see. You see a lot of circulatures, curvatures in mosque architecture because that enhances the acoustics. So when you give the namaz, it echoes out. That is the primary idea behind the architecture. So I introduce these curving movements, the circular movements in the Alarippu. And there was something that used to happen when I used to practice dance was that nearby a mosque loudspeaker would exactly start while I'm starting my practice.
My God, that was like a divine...
It was like an intervention.
Yeah, intervention.
So in my traditional Alarippu, I used this, I asked my dad to recite the namaz. I put it on a loop. So while I'm dancing, I do the namaz and break it down with the Alarippu movements. And that's how... And I think that has sort of sparked something now, and I want to take further this secular.
People are so conservative when it comes to these ideas of art, right? Sometimes if it's Bharatanatyam, a lot of people who practice this, they are not okay about it being mixed up with other forms of dance.
Yes.
And they can be very, very critical about it. Yeah. And how did you break out of this? Because, you know, Sufi music is still now accepted because I think Bollywood has done a great job with
that. Yes, definitely.
Right? And we owe it to the Bollywood movies because I don't know if really people would have known about Allahu, you know, Allahu, and they would have known about Damadam Maskalandar. None of them even actually probably know that Damadam Maskalandar is a Sindhi song, you know, for God.
Yeah.
And there is also all these other songs which I think Bollywood has done a great job of that.
Definitely,
you know?
Definitely.
I always say that they've done a fantastic job in making it. People may be listening to it and not knowing the meaning behind it, but it's accepted. But there are some forms like Bharatanatyam, there are some forms like, you know, Indian classical music that are all again, you know, based on religious text, based on a certain form of faith. How was your experience when you began in the beginning? Now I'm sure you're way more established and, you know, it's a lot more easier, or is it not?
Well, let me tell you first, it's still not easy. I have faced a lot of resistance, which is also why my work doesn't get shown in the typical Indian performing spaces, like the Chennai Sabhas that happen, or even the festivals that host Indian classical dance, because they see my work as not classical because the text primarily is not Hindu, if I may say so, or pertaining to any form of faith that is supposedly it's supposed to do. And I have faced a lot of resistance. I don't get performance slots. If I apply, my applications are not accepted. I don't even get a reason for it. I don't even get a response that it's not accepted. In fact, recently...
What does that do to you, Masu?
You know, initially, it was very, very disheartening. To the point that I stopped dancing for 5 years. I just stopped dancing. I said, I don't want to create, because I didn't want to create something that I didn't want to dance the typical traditional dances that everybody else was doing, because I didn't relate to it to a certain extent. I mean, I can mimic it. I can, like how actors put on a mask and they are doing this another persona. I could do it, but I felt somewhere I wasn't being true to myself. You know, and I also have a lot of issues in terms of consent and the sexual harassment that is shown and just passed off as a spiritual connotation, you know.
What do you mean when you say that?
For example, Krishna stealing the clothes of gopis. And there's this very famous incident in the scriptures where all these women are bathing in a yes. lake. And Krishna steals the clothes and he climbs up a tree.
Yes.
And then when they look, they don't find the clothes and they see he's up there. So he says, you have to lift your hands or whatever. Pray to me or something and then I will give you the clothes. So they come out of the water naked. And they bow to him and then he gives. I mean, when you're telling youngsters, this young children, these stories, what are you telling them? What about consent? And they're saying, oh no, it's a Paramatma telling, so you just give away yourself. I don't think, I think we are just brushing it under the carpet, under this garb of spirituality, you know. I'm not saying Islam is perfect. Islam has a lot of issues in itself. But when you're actively telling these stories to children from childhood, portraying it in a society, in a community, it is sort of then taken for granted that maybe you will be harassed. Like Krishna, there's this, again, thing about Krishna harassing a girl to a certain extent and then she turns and falls in love with him.
It's very interesting that you talk about patriarchy because that's something that I have been writing extensively about, you know, and I think today the world is changing and people are questioning all these things that has yes. been passed on as traditions and the conditioning. There is definitely a huge sect of people who are still not open to even having this sort of a conversation because they grow up with that entire faith, you know, that they have. And
I feel we should always question our faith and traditions. How do traditions happen? A group of people practice something over a period of time that becomes tradition. But those people are dead. They are no longer here. So your traditions must always evolve for them to survive. Like how we say Hinduism has been there from this century, Islam has been there from this century. But the reason they have survived is not because they have stood the test of time, but because they have evolved over a period of time.
And they've been inclusive also.
And they've been inclusive.
Yes.
You make those changes and then you become what you are right now.
Yeah.
And I've always faced this in my dance. So because of that, I also question the absence of homosexuality in these texts. Because you go to a Khajuraho temple, you have lesbian lovers on the wall.
Yes.
Right? And with classical dance, there's also this controversy that is actively still being debated. So we have a very famous poet called Kshetraya. He's supposedly a man who writes love stories from the perspective of women. And these are so evocative, they are so erotic that there has been a question as to was Kshetraya actually a man or was it a group of women who posed and used a man's name to be so that this work is sanctioned by the society and accepted?
Wow.
So where is the erotic and where is the devotional then? The sacred, the sensual and the sacred, where is that line? And I've always questioned this. I created a body of work where I use the Kshetraya poems which were very gender neutral and I made them as gay lovers, lesbian lovers and I danced that.
And help you with also expression for yourself for the things that yes. you were struggling with?
Yes.
So did you struggle being, part of the queer community and…
I didn't struggle with expression in the sense that I'm non-binary. I don't have a gender identity. And this is something that I came to much later in life is that my parents, while were cool, apparently my relatives were not very okay with it. So even when I was put in the… I was very effeminate. I would take my mom's dupatta and dance to Morni Bagama.
Oh, I love that song.
It used to be my childhood hit. Like every occasion I'm asked, I will take that. My mom had this yellow dupatta like Sridevi and I used to dance to that. I still remember it. So my relatives apparently were very apprehensive and they told my parents, oh, he's… you know, girly, he's this, he's that. He likes to dress up like a girl. He plays with dupatta and all. But my parents were very like, they were, I guess, probably they would have had their apprehensions, but they never put it on me.
Which is fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, so, hats off.
So I got to do anything that I got to do. Like today I wear what I wear and
it's
I walk.
It's absolutely gorgeous sarong.
Yeah. And my parents don't blink an eye because they are like, let him do what he wants to do. But yeah, in this society at large, there is always, you know, you get the looks. It's something you deal with. You learn to deal with.
But how difficult it is because, you know, there are so many times this whole, when we talk about inclusion, in reality, inclusion, does it really happen with the majority of the queer community, I find that they become friends with the people from their community because it's easier. They understand the pang, the trauma, the anguish, the whole acceptance. And there are a lot of straight people who may not be very open to inclusion. And have you faced that sort of a situation?
Sometimes, yes. It has not been very overt. Because I also come from a certain privilege of class and an economic background, right? So it is not very in my face. But of course, you get those stares, you get those looks. What I've surprisingly found is that people from the so-called backward classes have been more accepting than the educated masses. And that's something I've been thinking a lot about as to why. Because if you're so educated, you think it would make them open up to new experiences,
absolutely,
ideas, and all,
yeah,
accepting. But it's very interesting. It's the uneducated masses who have been more accepting of these binaries, of this fluidity in expressions, whether it be gender or sexuality, than the educated classes. But yeah, I have faced it. But I think after a point, Mahua, you reach where you just don't care. Because you realize that it's them, it's not you. And there is only, the only thing you can do is be yourself. And then they accept it or they don't. It's their problem, it's not your problem. You just do what you do. And you continue doing it as long as, I think, you're not killing someone or harming someone.
Or hurting somebody. Yeah.
Then it's fine. You just be.
So apart from dance, what is it that you do, Masoom? And how come the name Masoom? Masoom means innocence. And of course, you have innocence personified all over your face. But I doubt if you're that innocent. You have that little wicked look that's like coming right across to me. And you've broken a lot of hearts, I'm sure, by now. So tell me a little about how many hearts have you broken? And are you the sort who will not stay bound in a relationship and you'd like to discover many more people? That's how you come across to me. I could be wrong and you can correct me, because I think that is the way to be also in life, you know, but it's very difficult. But who is Masoom?
I always, whenever I introduce myself on dates, I say Masoom, just because, as you said, it's just the name. It's very ironic. I think my parents regret it. Apparently, my grandmom named me. And yes, I was actually named after the movie Masoom that came in 83.
Yes.
So, yeah.
That was a beautiful film.
It was a beautiful film, but yeah, it's just my name. That's Masoom, I don't think. Broken hearts? I've lost count, to be very honest.
Wonderful.
At one point, I wanted to settle down, have a family, have children. But I think the more I see the world, I experience the world, I realize that marriage is very good in theory. Practically, it doesn't work. Not for me, at least. I mean, those who it works for, very good. But I'm open to new experiences. And I think I have enough love in myself to give it to people.
So it must be making your partner insecure for the person that you are. Because I mean, the minute...
Yeah, which is why I haven't been in many relationships.
I can see that in you, because there is this whole innocence and there is this whole charm and there is this whole person who wants to experience life fully. And the partner may feel insecure. So does that happen?
It does. It has happened. Initially, I used to be this one very monogamous, monoandrous person where I'm like, my partner is my world, and that has happened where I've made them the center of my universe.
And that always, you know, you fall on your face.
Yeah, you fall on your face. You break your heart into a million pieces.
Yes.
They walk all over you and you are left shattered. But then I've also realized that there is so much love to share and give. And with, of course, safety precautions. So
we don't ask for that. But well, yes, I'm glad. I'm really glad about that.
So now I think I identify as polyamorous. But I haven't had a partner in a really long time. And COVID sort of has made it difficult. But I'm open. Let's see. We don't know. I think everybody should have multiple partners.
I just had a podcast just very recently with a woman called Anupama, and she's an amazing woman, and I will connect you with Anupama whenever she listens to this podcast. She should know she's doing a huge research on polyamory, and she spoke about polyandry, where women must have multiple partners to really experience their own sense of high living.
Yeah, and I think it's very important, because your one person cannot be your friend, your confidant, your sexual partner, your emotional well-being partner. You're punching back. No, it's too much to expect out of one person.
Yes. But I doubt if men will ever open up to their women going out, at least till the time I live.
I think people should go out with everybody, in the sense, they should be from your gender, they should be from the opposite gender. There's just such different experiences.
But do you realize that the entire social system may just completely, you know... It's just going to be chaotic if this happens.
I can
see the chaos, but...
I don't think it could be chaotic. I feel maybe initially it would be chaotic.
Yeah, it will.
But you might find some semblance and...
I think they'll be happier as
a lot
people.
Of problems will get solved, you know. I think it's very important for world peace. where you are just... Because, you know, there's so much frustration.
I think a happy person is more peaceful as a person. I agree with you fully on this one. Yes, I do.
And I also tell this to a lot of my straight friends, male and female, that you should have homosexual experiences. It may work for you, it may not work for you. I'm not saying everybody is bisexual. I don't think there are people who are like 100% straight and 100% gay. But you
there is
should
nothing
be,
called 100% ever.
Ever, but still, you should be open to the idea of having that experience. And it's okay if you want to keep it a secret. Keep it a secret. That's fine. Nobody needs to know what goes on in your bedroom, but have that experience. Put yourself out there.
So thank you so much, Masoom, for being on this episode. And you're not as Masoom as your name says. And I love it. And of course, you're a complete heartbreaker. An absolute charming human being who I'm trying to just keep my eyes away from, not staring at you. But before we end, please, can you share with us one of your favorite nazms on this episode?
I can't sing it. I'm really bad at it. And it's an irony that I come from a community of singers, but I can't sing. But I think my favorite nazm at the moment is, it's sung by Abida Parveen. I can't remember who has written it. It's, Woh jo hum mein tum mein karar tha, tumhe yaad ho ke na yaad ho, woh vaada ya nibah ka, tumhe yaad ho ke na yaad ho.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. To you, our dearest listeners, you can find us on your favorite streaming services. Find us on Spotify, Amazon Music, Apple Podcast, and of course, all other major streaming services. With loads of love, we are Moody Mo Awaaz Podcast, where Hatke is Hot.